You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
This is a song born in the struggle of the brave Chinese people. It begins, Chi Lai, arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves, and ends, Chen Jing, march on. Chi Lai, who you want so nul di run man, ba woman di xie.
中国民心的长城，中华民族到了最危险的时候，每个人得冒着发出最好的好伤。起来，起来，起来！我们万众一心，冒着敌人的炮火。 前进，冒着敌人的炮火，前进，前进，前进，进 ！Arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves, let's stand up and fight for liberty and true democracy. chains of the tyrant. Everyone who works for freedom is now crying, arise, arise, arise. All of us with one heart, with the torch of freedom, march on, with the torch of freedom, march on, march on, march on and on. Chilai, the Yuan Sonul di Ranman, Ba Woman di Sero, Su Chong Woman Sing di Chang Chang. Chong Hua Ming Su Dao Liao, Sui Wei Xie di Shi Hao. They poured your fortune, sway how the hall shung. She lied, she lied, she lied. All in one to me sing, Mao Zhe Di Shuan Di Pao Huo. Qin Jing, Mao Zhe Di Shuan Di Pao Huo. Qin Jing, Qin Jing, Qin Jing, Jing.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. Hello, comrades and friends. This is Siegfried, returning to the CFRU airwaves after a short leave of absence. So I hope you all are ready for an action-packed hour with Guelph's favorite hardline communist, because that's who I am. That, of course, was the great Paul Robeson with the March of the Volunteers, National Anthem of the People's Republic of China. And, of course, we started out with the usual 1977 October Revolution Day parade in Moscow, then in the Soviet Union. And that was, of course, the Soviet national anthem. Now, I think I'll start with the obvious. You know, where the hell was I this past year? Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a ESL teacher who has done a lot of work in China. And that's precisely where I was. This time I was teaching classes at a teacher's college in Ningbo, which is a little ways south of Shanghai on China's east coast. You might not have heard of it, but it's a city of about 8 million people. Larger than anything we've got in Canada, so coming back to Guelph took some getting used to, as it always does. Coming back to Ontario at a time when, you know, education, healthcare, and social spending are getting cut to the bone, where, by contrast, in China, the expansion of all three of those things is a major national priority. It's quite a shock to the system, I have to say. But I'm always happy to be back here at CFRU, even if Doug Ford is trying to put us on the chopping block now, along with just about every other progressive student-funded initiative out there. And now there's a real threat that the Conservatives are going to win the federal election in Ontario and try to turn back the clock on a lot of things. You know, it's not an easy time. But there can be no victories without struggle. Remember that, brothers and sisters. Just last month, speaking of struggle, basically right after I got back into town, I was proud to be a part of the resistance effort, led mainly by local communists and anarchists here in Guelph, that sent Maxime Bernier, the leader of the far-right Canadian People's Party, running for the hills with his tail between his legs after he tried to organize an event at the Guelph Youth Music Center. We managed to shut his ass down, managed to get the GYMC to stop the event. I mean, the very idea that the Guelph Youth Music Center would even consider hosting an event put on by the leader of a bigoted, racist, anti-immigrant, and frankly fascist party that has even echoed Donald Trump's rhetoric about building walls along the border to keep out black and brown people is just disgusting. The fact that they agreed to host it and would have let the event go ahead if not for our efforts to expose and condemn them is truly horrific. I mean, I've done a lot of work with Guelph Spoken Word, you know, the Guelph arts scene. We've often had our events at the GYMC in the past, and the idea that, you know, what we assumed to be a safe and progressive space would play host to fascists is very disturbing, to say the least. But I want to talk more about China. China, as many of you will know, is currently the second largest economy in the world. Although by certain measurements, such as purchasing power parity, basically the measurement of how much you get for your money in any given country, it has already surpassed the United States. Donald Trump has initiated a trade war against China, putting tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Chinese goods, while trying to blame China for practically every one of America's own economic difficulties in order to justify it, even though it's led to China taking retaliatory efforts and doing things like no longer buying American agricultural products, which has proven economically devastating to Trump's own electoral base. Doesn't seem to trouble him at all. And the general attitude toward China among the American political elite is almost universally hostile. And this is what I find to be very, very troubling. Very universally hostile, with even people like Bernie Sanders making similar comments as Trump, attacking China for supposedly taking American jobs. So instead of like people saying, you know, we should negotiate with China, we should have friendly relationships with China, this massive country, major economy in the world, instead there's confrontation. It's almost talk of war, really, is what you get in American politics right now. And that's very dangerous. I mean, just like the rhetoric towards Russia has been very, very dangerous. I mean, China has been regularly demonized in the mainstream media, which has become almost as hostile to China as it has been to Russia over the last few years. So that's a very difficult thing. You know, that's a very, as someone who was coming from Canada and going there and kind of seeing the deterioration of relations, I mean, that's a very unsettling thing for me, to say the least. And Canada, for its part, has mostly gone along with Trump's hostile policy towards China, most notably arresting and imprisoning Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of China's leading technology and cell phone manufacturing company, Huawei, pending extradition to the U.S. on accusations of trading American technology to Iran, a country which China has normal economic relations with, but which Trump has targeted for regime change. American sanctions on Iran are unilateral and they're therefore illegal under international law. And therefore, Meng Wanzhou and Huawei did nothing wrong by trading with Iran, making her detention, as the journalist Christopher Black has said, basically an illegal kidnapping. But that's what Trudeau allowed to happen, and he's kind of gone along with Trump on a lot of things, and that's also a very disturbing thing to see Canada doing. I mean, it's like, okay, they want to present themselves as kind of like the everybody's best friend, and yet they're palling around with Trump on things like on all kinds of like foreign policy questions, whether that's China, Venezuela, Syria, even Cuba now. You know, Canada's getting hostile with Cuba in different ways at the U.S. request. And they're also doing things like passing this new like NAFTA legislation, which is going to really mess up Canadian workers. But there's just collaboration across the board, you know, between Canada and the U.S. at this particular time. And, you know, while the... So, of course, and here's of course, the kicker. You know, while the U.S. is in the process of actively blockading and trying to literally starve the people of Iran and Venezuela into submission, it keeps screaming out about the current protests in Hong Kong and the human rights situation in what is a special autonomous region within China. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's always seemed a little bit rich to me hearing the leaders of an empire, you know, an empire based on the genocidal destruction of indigenous peoples, the enslavement of Africans, and so many assaults and regime change wars waged against independent nations across the world. It's really rich to hear them express concerns about the human rights situation in this or that country, whether it's China, Syria, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, or wherever. It also seems a little bit rich to me that these demonstrators in Hong Kong, whom some Western media outlets have labeled as genuine revolutionaries, are so keen on waving American flags, singing the American national anthem, and calling on Trump to, quote, save them, liberate Hong Kong, and defend our Constitution. These are literally the slogans on the signs that they hold. The same guy whose ICE goons have been locking up children in cages. That guy. These protesters want him to save them, like he's their knight in shining armor or something. And you know, these protesters in Hong Kong who took to the streets to oppose a extradition law that was later withdrawn and which would have allowed convicted criminals to be sent to mainland China from Hong Kong under certain circumstances. These protesters don't impress me, I'll be frank. They got what they initially wanted. The law in question was withdrawn. Now they're just going further and are basically pushing for regime change on behalf of Western interests. That's really what they're doing. They've effectively become tools of the United States. I mean, just today, President Trump proposed a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping over the situation in Hong Kong and made it blatantly obvious that he views these protesters as bargaining chips in potential trade talks with China. You know, he's going to support them, get them to mess things up in Hong Kong until China decides to come to the table and, like, accede to American demands, I guess, on the economic front. I mean, that seems to be how Trump views these protesters. They're pawns in his game, you know. And he's basically just going to use them to kind of mess around with China. That's really what he's trying to do. I mean, not all demonstrations are progressive, and I think that's really important to emphasize here. And I think some historical context is in order. Just last month I had the opportunity to interview Ian Goodrum, who is a journalist who is based in China. He's based with the newspaper The Global Times. The Global Times is based in Beijing. Last month, I had an opportunity to interview him on a podcast called The Communist Current, which I do with my friend and comrade, Clara Sorrenti. I really want to give a shout out to The Communist Current, not just because I'm its co-host, but because I also think it's crucial that radical analysis exists, given the times that we live in. And, you can find The Communist Current on SoundCloud and pretty much any other website where you can download podcasts. So check it out. We'll be adding lots more content in the future. And this is an excerpt from our discussion that me and Clara had with Ian Goodrum of the Global Times. And I think he also writes for the China Daily, and he's based in Beijing, China. So this is his take on what is going on right now in Hong Kong. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Right now there are contradictions within the system, but getting back to like what we were really going to talk about, certainly with regard to Hong Kong, you know, which of course going back to the 1990s, this the reunification of Hong Kong with mainland China in 1997 established this fundamentally a contradiction of one country, two systems. And so when you see today, sure, you see like the this protest going on in Hong Kong, process of a law which allows Hong Kong residents to be extradited to the mainland PRC under certain circumstances. And there's been major demonstrations in the territory, including instances of demonstrators breaking into the Legislative Assembly and raising the old British colonial era flag. I mean, can you go into detail, right, about like how these protests began and how they unfolded and how that relates to this whole contradiction, so to speak, that was really set up in 1997?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of factors at work here. Just like China, Hong Kong is not a monolith. There's lots of forces at work. But the handover itself, I mean, I think this has its roots in the nature of the handover. For all its bloviating and whining about how they didn't get a fair deal, the British had quite a lot of advantages in the negotiations for the handover. There was a kind of not militantly anti-colonial mood in the world at the time, but certainly it was a bad look for a country like Britain to maintain colonial possessions. So there was some disadvantage to the negotiating position of Britain at the time. But at the same time, they did hold quite a few cards, and one of which was because Hong Kong wasn't part of the revolution, because it wasn't incorporated into the PRC at its founding. You had a over 100-year history of colonization and subjugation by the British that was at first quite violent and outright, blatant, and then became, a kinder, gentler colonialism by the latter part of the 20th century. you had a situation where you couldn't fundamentally change key aspects of the Hong Kong system. You couldn't take what was a kind of hyper-capitalism, what was a, talking about private monopolies. You had, by that time, by the time of the handover negotiations and the handover itself, you had lots and lots of industry monopolization and the placing of economic power in the hands of an elite few. And they weren't going to cede their power willingly, as we know. This doesn't happen. So China was in the PRC was in a difficult position because they can't, you know, you can't change, you can't hope to win sovereignty back of Hong Kong from Britain peacefully if you don't accommodate these elites, these capitalists. And so they made a what at the time was probably somewhat of a difficult decision, but maybe not as much as it might be now if it were happening now. To not change too much of the Hong Kong system for the handover. You had colonial governors instituting some limited democratic reforms, but I think Hong Kong now is more democratic than it was under British holding. And so this was the bargain that had to be struck. You had to accommodate these people, and so you couldn't have a mainland style economic system because that would require most of the industries that are in private hands to go into state hands. You couldn't change too much. And so that was the agreement that was made. And so the handover happened. It was in terms of its actual economic content, not that significant of a change. The Hong Kong economy of today looks very much like the Hong Kong economy of a couple decades ago. It's bigger. It's been growing a lot. But it's but the fundamentals are still mostly the way they were before. So what happens here is what happens in any capitalist economy. You get these contradictions, you get these inequalities developing, you have this almost a caste system of Hong Kong people and their domestic help. You have this group of domestic help that, you know, works long hours, gets, if they're lucky, a day off. They have very small sleeping quarters. And this is the kind of situation, again, where because of the monopoly over industry, economic opportunities for people like students, younger people, the quote-unquote middle class, which I hate that term, but it does have a certain connotation that's useful in this context, the economic opportunities are limited to the point where a lot of people from Hong Kong are moving to the mainland to find work, to find good-paying work, which is a kind of funny inversion of how they probably expected things to be. For a long time, Hong Kong enjoyed its special status and enjoyed its kind of its relatively privileged position over the rest of China, and that hasn't changed either. So seeing the growth of the mainland is also a sticking point for a lot of people, because Hong Kong used to be really, really important to the Chinese economy when the handover happened and its economic, its role as a driver of economic growth was key. It's not so much now. You know, a city like Shenzhen is just as economically important, if not more so, now. So you don't have that kind of elite privilege that you might have had before. And this is not to say that these are motivating factors for everybody. There's a lot of stuff at work, but the overriding perception is that things should be better than they are. And rather than blame the elites, the people who actually own the industry and have the power in Hong Kong, the discontent gets projected onto the mainland and the CPC. And so what you get is any perceived incursion, and I very strong emphasis on perceived, because this extradition law, for example, is very lenient. China's extradition law is very normal in terms of how countries determine what a good what an extradition law is that keeps in with international norms. China has all the key elements of that. And they make concessions to their partners in extradition, just like every other country does. France is a good example. Like, for example, a lot of the argument that gets made by the people who are against this extradition law is that the mainland legal system is so distinct and so punitive and so, you know, they think it's like a kangaroo court. They say that it would be unfair to extradite Hong Kong people there because Hong Kong's legal system is so much better and transparent, what have you. But if this is the case, then why are countries like France, Switzerland, Italy, Spain agreeing to extradite people to China themselves. I mean, these are certainly Western nations with Western-style legal systems, but they made the agreement just like everybody, just like Hong Kong is refusing to do. And the best example of this, China made a concession to France in particular because a condition of the extradition agreement with China was that any person extradited from France to China, it has to be guaranteed that they will not receive a death sentence because France is against the death penalty. And China agreed to that. And if somebody is extradited to China from France, there is a guarantee they will not be sentenced or have the possibility of being sentenced to an execution. So these are things that China does. And similarly, this extradition law that was being proposed had quite a few conditions attached to it as well. The violation of a law in order to be extradited has to have a minimum jail sentence of 7 years. Now, the usual minimum, according to the extradition law of China, is just 1 year, but they added 6 to the minimum to accommodate these concerns. A law has to exist both in China and the country that it's extraditing from. That's true for Hong Kong. So if people think that there are arbitrary laws in China, I don't think that's true, but some people do. It doesn't matter, because if the law doesn't exist in Hong Kong, then you can't be extradited for violation of it. And political offenses are explicitly disallowed in terms of making these agreements. So it's, to my mind, I mean, I think there's a certain perception that anything the mainland does in relation to Hong Kong is an incursion on their independence, their quote-unquote independence, their sovereignty, what have you. And so tensions are very high, and so when something like this happens, there's a big response. And yes, many people are flying the colonial flag. It's all very embarrassing, this idea that things were better under the Brits. But it's not totally representative either. We can't, you know, there were a couple hundred thousand people at minimum, at maximum a million or possibly even 2 million people in the streets, and they weren't all waving colonial flags. So there's more at work there, even though that is an embarrassing segment of that movement, the people flying those flags, and of course the people putting it up at LegCo, at the Legislative Council. You know, the optics are very bad for people that are pro Hong Kong independence, but are you know, pro this protest movement. But at the same time, it does reveal a certain character. One of the big forces behind opposition, not everybody, but one of the factors was the quote unquote business communities, the elites, the tycoons didn't like this either, because financial crimes were covered under this extradition agreement. And so it meant that Hong Kong would no longer be a safe haven for financial criminals. So that was a big component of the opposition. It wasn't all of the opposition, but it was a significant portion. So it's a very complex kind of question, but you can see the treatment it's been getting in the Western press. You can see the statements that have been put out by former colonial administrators, most notably Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong. And then this, you know, the Chambers of Commerce of Hong Kong and the United States and various other countries coming out against this. I mean, clearly there is a segment of this that is purely oppositional, because it means the capitalist classes in Hong Kong might face some consequences for financial crimes. But it's not the whole thing. But that certainly is a factor we can't ignore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what has the – I mean, obviously we know the Western press has been all over this, Western governments have been all over this, but what has the Western role really been in terms of supporting these protests and like really kind of fueling the fires here? I mean, has there actually been money coming in? Has there been assistance coming in, like for these, this protest movement in terms of, from the National Endowment for Democracy, for example? No.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Yes. But you know, there, And imperialism is very good at kind of at taking existing discontent and magnifying it and amplifying it and making it seem, you know, like this grand existential threat to countries that it's targeting. So we can't, you know, we can't ignore that either. Of course, the National Endowment for Democracy has been funneling money in. But this is also, you know, the people are genuinely miffed about this. I don't think their concerns are correctly placed. I think their concerns should be with the people that are exploiting them directly, the people that own the key planks of the economy that keep prices high, that keep costs high. You know, the landlord monopolists. There's only two there's only two legally allowed food importers into Hong Kong from China or the rest of the world even. I mean, so this creates inevitable monopolies on essential goods. It's kind of the opposite of what we were just talking about before. You know, there's no subsidies because private hands control the things people need. And so rather than direct their ire at the people that are responsible for that, the people that are exploiting them, they call the PRC a colonizer. They call the CPC a colonizer. But, you know, if there's anything happening colonially where there's exploitation going on, you know, you need only look at the people at the top of your, you know, your situation. Mm. And, you know, there are burgeoning movements in opposition. I think the best one being the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions, which is a large, I think the biggest trade union federation in Hong Kong, but also a political body that has elected members in LegCo.
Right.
And this, I think, is the future, should be the future of a progressive movement in Hong Kong. You know, it's, you know, these levers exist and it's going to be difficult to affect real change through them, but it is possible. You have to build this consciousness, and I think that's one way of doing it. So labor activism is getting stronger, and it's being channeled through this, you know, through this organized body that is able to put this into practice, and if they get a sizable enough representation of the government, put it in through policy. I think that's the future. Right? I don't think these big confused protest movements are the way to go, because everybody's got an agenda,
right?
And so certainly some aspects of that can be exploited by outside forces, and we know this to be true. The links are there, but we can't overemphasize those either. You know, they're a factor and they exist, just like for example in left politics in the West. You know, infiltration is a factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, subversion is a factor, but it's not, we can't be thinking about that all the time. You know, subversion of mass movements exists in China as well, and they're exploiting existing negative sentiment and perhaps growing it and amplifying it. But in order to address it, we need to be comprehensive. In order to put things on the right path, we can't be so dismissive. And so, I think there are existing channels to do that work. But certainly, yes. We can't pretend it's totally purely organic and that there aren't nefarious forces to some degree at work, because this is what imperialism does. Like decoupling Hong Kong from China and creating those divisions and intensifying those divisions absolutely serves the interest of the imperial bourgeoisie and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all those countries that are in concert with one another to maximize exploitation of the global South.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was journalist Ian Goodrum of the China Daily and of Global Times, based in Beijing. And that was him speaking on the Communist Current podcast, July edition, which was entitled China and the Trade War. And once again, I would really encourage you to check that out. That's on SoundCloud, and that's on just about every other platform there is. Where you can download podcasts. And once again, I'm a co-host of that podcast along with my friend and comrade Clara Sorrenti. So please check us out. Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi everybody, this is Lee Fields. You're listening to CFRU. You heard me, CFRU.
Guelph Bug Day is a fun, free, educational event for community members of all ages. Our goal is to cultivate a fascination for the very cool, very small world of insects. Come get up close and personal with our live specimens. Take one, or two, or three. guided bug catching hikes in the expansive and beautiful grounds at the University of Guelph Arboretum. Try tasty insect cuisine, put your imagination to the test with insect drawing contests, and explore the variety of buggy vendors that Guelph has to offer. Also new this year are pinning workshops and a guided tour of the honeybee research station. Rain or shine, bring your adventuring spirit and prepare to be amazed. Guelph Bug Day is taking place August 25th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Arboretum Center at the University of Guelph. This event is physically accessible.
No bumps on this ride, let it glide with Planet Groove and your funky blues doctor serving you up an audio buffet every Friday at 10 a.m. of blues, rock, funk, and more on CFRU 93.3 FM, baby.
New from the War Amps.
Did you know that a second of fun in the wrong place could change your life forever?
My name's Rebecca, and I lost my leg in a boating accident.
Lots of kids in our Child Amputee Program have their own stories. Now, we help kids to play safe.
Take from us, accidents can happen to anyone, anywhere.
Watch the War Amps new Play Safe video at waramps.ca. Play safe!
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So we had Ian Goodrum there before the break, an excerpt from the Communist Current podcast that I do with my comrade Clara Sorrenti. I want to talk now a little bit more about my experience in China. This is the third time I've been to China, working there, doing this ESL thing, and each time I've been there, I've been to a different city. You know, the first time I was in Tonglao, the Inner Mongolia Autonomous Zone, which I'm sure is not the kind of place that most people go to China for the first time to do ESL work, but I did. You know, this kind of city of 500,000 people off, you know, in the northern grasslands close to the Mongolian border. it's not the kind of place you would think of, but that was where I went to. That's where I taught at the university there. Then I taught. The second time I went, I was in Suzhou, a city of 8 million people just to the west of Shanghai. That's another, you know, not exactly the most well-known place, even though it is a major city. And then Ningbo, which is of equivalent size, you know, the place I just came back from. It's about the equivalent size, about 8 million people, still bigger than anything that's any city in Canada, but not very well-known, I'm sure, in this country. And all my experiences in all these places have been different. The kinds of things I've been teaching, you know, when you're teaching to a university audience, as I did in Tonglao, you're kind of in the lecture hall and you're kind of teaching in that context. The second, I was kind of more at a semi-private kind of school where I was teaching history, world history. And the third, I was at a teacher's college. This time I was actually at a teacher's college in Ningbo. Teaching people who want to, for the most part, teach younger students. Some of them were wanting to become preschool teachers. Basically, I was just helping them improve their English, specifically their spoken English, and just talking them through that, helping them out with that. But one of the common things which I found, and I've done this everywhere I've been, everywhere I've taught in China, as kind of what I feel is my responsibility as somebody who's coming from Canada, when I talk about this country, when I talk about the history of this country, I have to be real with people over there. I have to tell them the real history of Canada. And that means talking about the ugliness of that history. That means talking about settler colonialism. That means talking about the genocide of Indigenous people. You know, the ongoing genocide of Indigenous people in this land, and just how settler colonialism is the fundamental contradiction in Canadian society right now. That's the thing that really underpins everything in this country, effectively, is the fact that this country, just like Australia, just like the United States, just like New Zealand, just like Israel, all these places are founded on the genocide of the Indigenous population, the expulsion of the Indigenous population, the slaughter of the Indigenous population, the oppression and attempted eradication of the Indigenous population, and the replacement of the Indigenous population with basically settlers coming from another continent. You know, that's what happened in these particular countries. Canada is one of them. And we're talking about a genocide that is, you know, on a massive scale. And it happens over a long period of time and is still going on now. You look at the experience of Indigenous people today and the kind of conditions they undergo and how they got to fight for everything in the society. You know, and it's a constant struggle for them, you know, to this day. You know, even though now we don't have, you know, the last residential school has been closed down and whatnot, you know, they're still facing these kinds of conditions, oppressive conditions. You know, kind of crushing conditions that are weighing down on them. You know, and they're marginalized in the society. You know, and now they're facing like down stuff like pipelines, tar sands, you know, extractive industry coming in and trying to take their land. You know, they're still facing that. They're still facing violence from the police. In a disproportionate racialized kind of way. You know, they're still facing like oppression from the government. You know, they're still dealing with the Indian Act. You know, all this stuff, you know, like they don't have clean water. You know, all this kind of stuff, they're still dealing with it. You know, they're still fighting to protect their land. You know, they're still fighting for their survival. This is still going on. And this is what I have to tell people when I go to China, because this is what they don't know. They don't know very much about Canada. Maybe they know about Niagara Falls or the CN Tower, but they don't know very much about this place. And I have to, and I feel it is my responsibility when I go over there, I have to, when I talk to them about this country, I have to tell them about this stuff, this real history, this real, the real situation in this country. I have to be real with them. I have to be honest. It's not an easy conversation to have, but it needs to happen. And I do that every time, and I'm amazed every time, maybe I shouldn't be, of just how much they understand. It's not difficult for them to understand. Like what colonialism has done to this country and to Indigenous people in this country. It's not hard for them to understand because they experience colonialism themselves. You know, going from the Opium Wars in the 1840s, where, you know, the British Empire first imposed its will on China with the sword and the gun, you know, to the Japanese invasion. You know, the Second World War for China began in 1937. They had a long Second World War indeed with the Japanese invasion, genocidal occupation of Chinese land, and the most horrific violence imaginable against Chinese people on a mass scale. This is the kind of thing which China has faced in the last 200 years. So they understand what it means to fight against and to resist colonialism and to fight for their own self-determination, their own independence, their own self-determination, their own survival. They know what that means. They can empathize with what Indigenous people undergo in this society right now, in Canada right now, on that basis. And I find that, you know, whenever I go over there and I tell them about this stuff, they get it. You know, I tell them about Louis Riel, they understand that. They understand where he's coming from. How he's fighting to protect his people against this oncoming invasion, which is really what he was facing up to in Western, you know, what is now Manitoba and Saskatchewan and Alberta in the 1870s. You know, he was facing up against an invasion that was trying to, like, you know, basically subjugate his people, even wipe them out. And he was fighting to defend the Métis and their rights and their land, their self-determination, like from the Canadian Army, you know, and they understand that. You know, they understand when I tell them about, like, you know, his trial, him being put on trial by an all-white kangaroo court and executed just because he defended his people and dared to rise up and resist colonialism. You know, they understand that. They understand, like, why that happened and what a crime that was, and that he was executed in that way, you know, by an invading army, effectively. I mean, like, you know, I even, like, talked about it. This is almost like if a Chinese person who was resisting the Japanese occupation, if he was put on trial in a Japanese court That's basically what happened to Louis Riel. You know, he was fighting to defend his people, and he's put on trial in a court of white Anglophones, and then he's executed. You know, executed by the colonizer. So Chinese people, they really grasp what it means to fight for self-determination, fight for independence, resist colonialism. They get that stuff. You know, you can talk to them about that. And it's not hard to make them understand. You know, because they know their own history. So that's something I find very, very striking over here. And I like really contrast that with my experience talking to white Canadians about this kind of subject matter, you know, and they just, a lot of cases, they just don't get it. That's not in their experience. That's not in their historical memory. They don't, they just don't grasp what it means to fight like that. You know, against colonialism. To fight for their own self-determination, for their own independence, this kind of thing. You know, unless they're from Ireland or something. You know, it's like, yeah, this is the thing. It's a difficult conversation to have in, like, once again, the settler colonial society that we live in. But it needs to happen. And obviously there are people who are doing that. There's, you know, it's an ongoing struggle here. You know, for justice. And I try to play my part. Now, and this particular thing which I want to share with you, this song, which I think I've only played one time, maybe last year on the show, back when I was still on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. Now, Willie Dunn was a Métis, I believe, singer-songwriter from the 1960s, 1970s. And this is a song he did called The Ballad of Crowfoot, and was made into a short film on the Canadian Film Board in the 1970s. And it talks about Crowfoot, who was one of the major chiefs in Saskatchewan, who basically was fighting to protect his people around this time, the same time Louis Riel was resisting colonization. And this really tells his story. And this was one of the things that my students found really, really striking, like talking about how at the beginning of Crowfoot's life in the 1820s, you know, his people, the Blackfoot, were an independent people, independent nation. They had their own customs. They had everything. They could, you know, they had self-determination. By 1890, when Crowfoot dies, they have lost that self-determination. Now they are under the boot of the colonizer. And they're forced to live on reservations. They're starving, riddled with disease, all this kind of stuff. And like, this is where they end up in the 1890s. And you know, communicating that to my Chinese students was, you know, they once again understood what that was, because they know what it's like to have to resist colonialism. So what I'm going to play right now, this is Willie Dunn, The Ballad of Crowfoot. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Comes the spring, and its warm thaw around your neck, the eagle claw upon your head, the buffalo horn. Today a great new chief is born, so raise them fast towards the sun. Heart now beats, a life's begun. It's 1821. Today a Blackfoot soul is born. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Your years are gone, the years have passed. Your heart is set, your soul is cast. Stand before the council fire. You have the mind and the desire of notions wise. You speak so well, and in brave deeds you do excel. And it's 1853, and you stand the chief of Confederacy. You are the leader, you are the chief. You stand against both liar and thief. They trade, raise whiskey, steal your land, and they're coming in swift like the wind-blown sand. They shoot the buffalo, kill the game, and send their preachers into shame. And it's 1864, and you think of peace, and you think of war. Profit, profit, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. See the settler in more numbers. He takes whatever he encounters. You seem the Sioux, all battered, beaten, wrong and right. They haven't eaten, and as per se, we're much the same. It seems like such a heartless game. And it's 1876, and the enemy's full of those death-dealing tricks. Today the treaty stands on the table. Will you sign it? Are you able? It offers food and protection too. Do you really think they'll hold it true? It offers a reserve. Now, isn't that grand? And in return you see all of your land. And it's 1877, and you know the scales are so uneven. Profit, profit, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Buffalo are slaughtered, there's nothing to eat. The government's late again with the meat, and your people are riddled with the white man's disease. And in the summer they're sick, and in the winter they freeze. And sometimes you wonder why you signed that day, but they broke the treaties themselves anyway. And it's 1889, and your Death Star explodes, and then it falls. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many. many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. The years have gone, the years have flown, the nation since has swiftly grown, but yet for the Indian, it's all the same. There's still the hardship, there's still the pain, there's still the hardship, there's still the strife. Its bitterness shines like a whetted knife. There's still the hypocrisy and the hate. Was that in the treaties? Is that the fate? We're all unhappy pawns in the government's game, and it's always the Indian who gets the blame. It's a problem which money can never lessen, and it's 1967. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Maybe one day you'll find honesty instead of the usual treachery. Perhaps one day the truth shall prevail, and the warmth of love which it doesn't take. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
Every Wednesday morning, here on CFRU, the stillness and the dancing brings you sounds local to global. Dubbed the best show to stay in bed for, the stillness and the dancing has you searching for the sublime in the simple. Give your ears some solace. Highlights from the world of ambient, drone, electronic, neoclassical, and post-rock. This will be your quiet corner of sonic comfort food in a chaotic world. Soon to be your favorite introverted musical retreat every Wednesday morning, 9 to 11 a.m. here on CFRU, 93.3 FM in Guelph.
New from the War Amps.
Did you know that a second of fun in the wrong place could change your life forever? name's Rebecca, and I lost my leg in a boating accident.
Lots of kids in our child amputee program have their own stories. Now, we help kids to play safe.
Take from us, accidents can happen to anyone, anywhere.
Watch the War Amps new Play Safe video at waramps.ca.
Play safe.